and welcome to another episode of Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Danielle Hanley. And joining me on the other line, he left his plate at the table and he'll suffer the consequences in the morning. It's John McMahon.
Thank you, Danielle. You have been to my apartment. You know that the dishes get done immediately.
In this house,
the dishes get done immediately.
I have been trying to be better about not leaving my dishes all for Friday morning.
You and Henry have never been more kindred spirits.
Seriously. The problem is that I have so many dishes, so I don't need to do them right away. I think I need to get rid of some of my dishes so that I am, like, forced to, like, clean them right away.
That's a good strategy, actually.
Listen, I know that that's the kind of incentive that I need.
Yeah.
I mean, we are here to talk about dishes, but also, what else are we here to do, John?
Talk about incentives and capitalism?
Well, we'll get there, too.
We, Danielle, are talking about Americans, Season 4, Episode 10, entitled Munchkins, directed by Steph Green and written by Peter Ackerman. Danielle, what's our summary this week?
The IMDb summary for Munchkins is, when Paige's long-ago indiscretion threatens to resurface and destroy the family, Philip and Elizabeth find themselves scrambling, and Paige finds herself reevaluating who her parents really are.
Honestly, maybe the best summary they've ever done.
I was just going to say, I was like, that actually feels pretty spot on.
Yeah. Like, it's actually good summary writing because it doesn't specify exactly how and why other than, like, there's Pastor Tim and Alice stuff. And, yeah. Like, the plot itself is a little bit bonkers, although, like, both a semi-win and major L for the Danielle dossier. So, like, slightly able to be anticipated.
Listen, I am not calling it an L, just like I said to you before we started. I know that you want this to be an L, but, like, it's not an L until, like, the credits on the last episode of the series roll and Pastor Tim and his Victorian ghostly face are still fucking there. Okay?
Do you expect this to be a show that, like, wraps up all of its, like, questions and, like, loose ends, or one that, like, has some kind of resolution but also leaves a lot open-ended? On the basis of, like, the vibe of the show and, like, does narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to leave open questions, but I think it's going to wrap up. Like, there's going to be some finality to it, but, like, that doesn't mean that the, like, questions won't be open. I envision it to function a lot like some of the season finales do, which is, like, oftentimes they are resolving something big and also opening other questions. And so I could see a version of that where, like, the resolution feels done, but also not, like, unless, like, the last episode has them all dead, which I just don't think it will have. Like, I think it has to, like, leave questions open.
Yeah.
I hope that Pastor Tim is dead, but, like, that's a different
thing. Do you think we will know whether Pastor Tim is dead or not?
Oh, my God. At the end of the season. Fucking better.
At the end of the show, I should say.
We better.
Just asking some, like, general, major big picture questions casually here in not quite the middle, but actually moving towards the end of season 4. And, like, maybe that's a little bit why this was on my mind, is that, like, there are only 3 episodes of season 4 left.
Yeah, which feels pretty wild because it does feel like we just started the season yesterday. But part of that is because we were, like, in the same 2 weeks for so many episodes.
There's the meta reason for us, and then there's the plot of the show. There's that, which is the plot reason for the show, but then there's also the fact that we have just recorded a shit ton of podcasts in December and January 2023 to 2024.
This is true. This is true. Before the end of January, we'll be done with this season, which feels
most likely, yeah,
exciting, and also, like, we just started this season in roughly December. Which, it wasn't that, but, like, it feels a little bit like that.
It's also sad because presumably we won't be recording more Americans until, like, late summer at the earliest.
Yeah.
I'll be busy and getting Regan to do more Popeverse content.
Feel like that's not going to be hard. So
we know I love the Popeverse, and Regan already committed to do it on air, so that's a binding contract.
Exactly.
You might say, Danielle, that I entrap Regan into season two of Popeverse. We might say I entrapped you into answering big picture questions and making predictions with no preparation about the entire end of the series, The Americans.
I'm here for it.
And we might say that this is an entire episode about entrapment, Danielle. Can we say that?
Indeed, we might. Yeah. No, I like that. I like thinking about entrapment in this episode.
It's a theme that's on one level, like, a play on a number of themes that we have engaged throughout the entirety of The Americans, right? It's tied to things like secrets and truth-telling. It's tied to things like honesty. It's tied to things about narrative structure, because, like, what is a viewing a TV show if not, like, finding yourself entrapped by the creators of that TV show? So there are a lot of things that we regularly talk about that tie into this. But then we, like, actually get the explicit narrativization of entrapment by Adderholt himself in this episode. And, like, I'm fine with following that blaring red light, right? Because, like, in this episode, Adderholt tells Stan that he is doing an entrapment with Martha's dad. It is not wrong.
Yeah.
And then, like, that is an, I think, ineffective entrapment, because this is a Stan, like, mixing up his professional and his, like, personal selves and not being able to reconcile them, like, story of his fucking life, right? And, but there are a lot of entrapments that are successful, both long-running and in the moment of this episode.
Just a note, one, fully agree, and I like the theme of entrapment. Two, just a note on the Stan Adderholt, and when Adderholt is like, Stan, people call that, like, we call that entrapment. I got sad because I was like, oh, I thought that Stan was trying to, like, hang out with Adderholt, because now he's, like, realized that Adderholt's a good dude because of all the Martha stuff. But, like, of course, not the case. Stan, incapable of, like, disentangling his, like, weird broiness and, like, his job. And so, entrapped and Adderholt.
And Adderholt is himself also somewhat disappointed in that moment. Like, he thought that they were just hanging out, just the two of them. Like, they were going to go be bros and get some beers together. But that's, like, definitely not what actually happens.
Yeah, and that made me sad for Adderholt and also sad for Stan, because I do feel like there was an opening there that he is like, oh, no, actually, like, I only view you as my work colleague, which maybe is not a bad thing, but I wanted him to view him as something more.
Yeah. And what did you think about that scene with Martha's dad itself, where Stan, I think, realizes in the moment that he's actually in over his head and that the emotional currents are, like, much too overwhelming for him to be able to do whatever instrumental FBI thing he was seeking to do in that moment. Part of that is Martha's dad's simultaneous, I think, denial and also, like, affirmation of Martha's personhood in the face of, like, the way that both the FBI and KGB in very, very different ways have instrumentalized Martha. And we see that, like, in the language that Martha's dad is using, in contrast, particularly with Stan's language. And I think that Adderholt is trying to, like, mediate between the two.
I think that's right. I think Adderholt is trying to soften things a little bit. And Stan is sort of like, it's not that he goes in guns blazing, but, like, he's got a purpose. And, like, and then is I think, thrown off guard by the way that Martha's dad is so insistent about Martha's character. And, like, I was personally struggling. I said this to you before we started recording. This episode has so many threads, so it was, like, hard for me to keep track of all of them. And I was trying to figure out, well, like, what is the FBI purpose of meeting with Martha's dad? Like, ostensibly, it's, like, trying to get a better sense of, like, who Martha was as a person to, like, flesh out that a little bit.
And this is the entrapment part. I think Adderholt thinks that Stan's plan is to try to get Martha's dad to say if he has had any contact with Martha as a way to then gain leverage over Martha through her dad. That's my reading of the situation. Like, I'm not sure that that's right.
That makes sense to me. I think the other thing that I was thinking is, like, Martha's dad has met Clark, so, like,
there's also that, of course.
Which, like, that part didn't seem to come up, and I guess that would have been, like, that would have been where my questioning went.
Yeah, and I think we're to assume that that line of questioning has already happened because there's, like, a secondhand reference or, like, passing reference to Clark or whatever his name was by Martha's dad. So, like, that has been brought up as a topic of conversation. And then I'll just focus on one line that gets said in this scene, and that is, like, a line about entrapment, right? That I forget if it's Stan or Adderholt who says to Martha's dad that it's the understanding and decent people who are most susceptible to manipulations.
Yeah.
Which, like, A, thesis statement for part of the entire show.
Yeah.
B, thesis statement for this episode. C, like, oddly aligned with the ways that Elizabeth has negged Martha in certain ways, that like there's this constant infantilization or simplification, which is of course gendered, of Martha by the various people who are like in her orbit.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was thinking about it like, yes, this is a thesis statement for this episode and for this show, and then also just for like for Martha and for everything with Martha. It's like precisely the fact that she's like a good human and nice that like she is a vulnerable target, right?
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's not exactly, it's not wrong.
No, right? It's not wrong. But the point about, I like appreciate your point about how it matches the way Elizabeth sort of treats Martha, both in the, like, yes, she's in the last episode and the episode before, she's like trying to neg Martha in a way, but also trying to like establish a kind of difference or a distinction between her and Martha as a way like back into Philip, right? Like after Martha leaves. Mm-hmm. And so like, mm-hmm. I didn't read that fully as negging her, though like that's how Philip takes it. She's just trying, she's like stumbling around for a word that makes sense. And like, yeah, it's that I think she calls her simple, but like not in the dumb sense, just in the like, you know, she's not a spy sense. And also in the dumb sense, but
I think Elizabeth was negging her, maybe unintentionally or unconsciously, but like, I think in that moment, Elizabeth was negging Martha. And then Elizabeth tries to save face by saying, and I think this is all on Carrie Russell's face. And then like, I think it's Elizabeth trying to save face, be like, I don't mean simple as in not smart. I mean, you know, simple in this other way.
I don't think that she was trying to neg Martha. I mean, I think that's 100% how Philip hears it. And yes. I do think that, like, she doesn't have, like, a particularly high opinion of Martha. But I don't think in that moment that she's trying to be like, Martha sucked, so get over her. Just, like, she's trying to articulate why it makes sense for Philip to like her. And I think it's more her, like, again, it's, like, it's drawing these distinctions with herself, because I think that's the tension that Elizabeth is experiencing.
That's a really good reading of the situation. I hadn't quite thought of it as that angle before. And I would agree with that reading. And I think the question is, does Elizabeth, I think unconsciously, then intend a, like, this is a difference, or this is a difference plus a hierarchization?
I think that's the second, right? Difference and hierarchization. But, like, that's always the way. I don't think that's Martha specific, but that's always the way Elizabeth, like, experiences people.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like there are very few people that Elizabeth experiences that don't have, like, some kind of hierarchy.
I mean, another place, or I should say another person or group of people that Elizabeth and maybe also Philip think are extremely below them in the hierarchy is Pastor Tim and especially Alice, right?
Yeah.
And this is the episode in which Alice is like, oh, you think that I'm just like the Christian wife who is extremely pregnant and far along in her pregnancy at this point and like just hanging out and chilling? No, I have come to fuck up your lives and particularly come to fuck up your family and maybe have like run an entrapment con on you.
It's honestly wild. Like, one, she comes in guns blazing. We've literally never heard a peep from this woman before, or like barely, you know, very like the counterexample of pastor's wife, like, just, like, yelling, screaming, like, threatening, right? And then it's, like, in the moment, she's, like, I have a tape and I sent it to a lawyer and, like, they're going to send it to the DOJ, right? And then it's unclear if there was a tape, if she sent it to a lawyer. Like, it's unclear if that actually transpired or she's just saying that to them. Like, that was the way that I read the phone call or the like, listening that Philip does and then reports in the kitchen where it's like, oh, she doesn't say anything about a tape or a lawyer. But, like, obviously, like, she says stuff about Pastor Tim. But that, like, threat matrix, which is a word I'm an idea I'm stealing from you, the like Alice, Paige, Philip, and classic Elizabeth
make a joke and it gets taken by one of us way too seriously.
That threat matrix is like very stressful because it's like this thing that Paige did where she's already been made to feel really bad about it by Elizabeth and like already kind of been warned about it by Philip and Elizabeth in these various ways. And it's already impacting her life in like very profound ways that we talked about last episode, where now she's like reporting on Pastor Tim and Alice, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that. But now it causes her to like doubt whether or not her parents were a part of Pastor Tim's disappearance when they have explicitly worked over and over, like they've like basically gone against orders or like had to reshape the plan because they know how invested in Tim and Alice Paige is. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's like a really excellent use of Alice. So Alice is played by Susie Jane Hunt as a kind of chaos agent.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, like this is going to be way over reading and like inserting into a Cold War metaphor, but it's the Americans and this podcast. So we're here for it.
Yeah.
But like, there's a way in which the Pastor Tim Jennings relationship has like achieved some sort of like Cold War sort of situation where there's tension, there's conflict, things are unresolved, there's an irreducible tension or conflict, or so it appears, and yet they've, like, agreed to some form of kind of détente as long as everybody keeps up appearances. And then it's Alice who comes in and fucks that whole thing up in a moment of, like, the Cold War, which is always already a hot war, becomes more vividly a hot war with when Pastor Tim, in this case, is, like, lost in Ethiopia. A USSR client state, is our resident geopolitics experts of the Americans all note.
You could not have paid me to know that Ethiopia was a client state of the USSR. Like, there's no amount of money that would have, like, allowed me to know that. I was like, oh, wow, we're all learning stuff about the world today. No, but I love a metaphor and détente was the thing that jumped to my brain, which is like they have reached a kind of détente and Alice is like, oh, absolutely not. Like, I see you for who you are. What's interesting about that? And it's interesting in a number of ways, but the thing that jumps out as interesting to me is like Pastor Tim and Paige have always been like, Pastor Tim's like, I tell Alice everything. Like, she's my partner. Like, you can trust her, blah, blah, blah. Paige obviously trusts Alice, like, for the most part, up until this episode. And then she's the one that, like, shoves it back in the Jennings family's face. The other, like, interesting link, right, at the end of the last episode when Pastor Tim is like, we're going to have to chat about Paige when I get back. Like, this is not great. It's like, oh, we're not waiting till Pastor Tim got back. We are just, like, fucking shit up from the jump. Here we go.
Yeah. There's so much there in what you said. Do you want me to extend this bad metaphor further first?
Obviously, yes. 1,000,000%. Okay.
So there's a sense in which what Alice tries to do in this episode, again, to go to, like, pure defense brain, like, defense derangement syndrome thinking. Like, she tries to create mutually assured destruction when before there was, like, only first strike capabilities for the Jennings to, like, murk Tim and Alice.
Wow.
And the tape is, like, the mutually assured destruction part. Huh? Yeah? We like this read? We hate this read.
No,
you gave me when I articulated it was something else.
I just, like, wasn't expecting Mutually Assured Destruction. I feel like I'm in 10th grade American history, and, like, these are identifications on an exam. And it's, like, Mutually Assured Destruction, détente. Like, all of these are things that I definitely wrote about in, like, an AP class at some point. And a DBQ.
Check us on our Cold War metaphors if you're listening to this one.
No need to be checked.
He established he occasionally listens.
Oh,
Keller.
Yeah, no. I wasn't. That wasn't the thing. It was more. We don't need to be checked by him. You're, like, nailing this.
Also, don't know about that.
You're, like, our resident Russia expert.
And, like, in the Tom Friedman sense, unfortunately.
Compared to me, who doesn't know where it is on a map.
More substantive than that.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So, more substantively in response to what you said, like, I think there's kind of two directions to go. And tell me, like, where we go first. I'll lay them both out for you. I think one is, there's thinking about this, like, theme of entrapment. There's a way in which this episode highlights the, like, mutual overlapping, intersecting, like, compositing ways in which Paige has been entrapped in all of these relationships. And in so, like, what is her sense of self and how does she act out in response to them is, I think, kind of one direction to go in. And another direction to go in is, and it's not totally dissimilar, but, like, the conversation that Paige, Elizabeth, and Philip has, where Paige is like, am I going to self-destruct this one? I'm going to self-destruct this one, right? Where, like, she goes, is there any way? And then she realizes how mad that makes Elizabeth, and she keeps trying to stop. And Elizabeth keeps prompting her to go and finish that thought and finish that sentence and, like, make her do so, which, like, she, more so than Philip, like, they play, Philip is, like, good cop, Elizabeth is bad cop, or whatever. Yeah. And, like, Elizabeth is pissed about this. Philip kind of answers more or less calmly. And then I think the most telling moment is after Paige storms off, Philip is like, is there any way this was us?
I know.
Right? She's not wrong. Paige is not wrong.
Well, and we know that, so let's start there, and then let's go back to Paige's sense of self, because I like that question too, but I think this is a more immediate, like, within the episode sort of question.
Yeah.
So, like, we, as the audience, know that Paige is not wrong, because we know that that was, like, very much on the table. Not Ethiopia, but, like, that, like, the surprise disappearance of Pastor Tim and or Alice, like, has been on the table before. And so when Philip asked that question, I don't know, I have the same question, which is, like, is it possible that this is, like, that this is some operation that we're only learning about now, or some version of that, or that the center took it upon themselves to, like, take out Pastor Tim?
I think that's the question that Philip is asking, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think the other part of this that is, like, pressing to me is where it's the second conversation that they have later, where Paige is like, well, what happens? And Elizabeth's like, well, if this is the case, if she did send if she sent a tape, then we would have to leave. And Paige is like, you and Dad? And she's like, no, you idiot. All of us. Like, come on, man.
Yeah.
And then she's like, what are we going to go to Russia? What do you mean back? I've never been to Russia. How can you be a Russian spy in Russia? Who are you going to disappear there?
All great questions.
Honestly?
On point. Every single one.
Fully on point.
Can I add something that I love about that particular scene?
Yeah, yeah.
It's, I feel like I'm doing a Danielle, like, turn of phrase here, but we also get Telltale Henry, right? Because, like, Henry is, like, throwing the tennis ball up against the garage door,
oh,
whatever the fuck
God.
He's doing to make that noise. And the sound design just, like, bumps that up in the mix so loud. Elizabeth, Philip, and Paige all comment on it. Elizabeth, it's like amplifying the tensions that they're all feeling and experiencing, and at the same time commenting to us as viewer on the tension in the scene as well. So it's just like, it's a cute gag and also extremely effective.
I was ready to go and, like, murder Henry. Like, please stop. It's impossible to concentrate, which is, like, you know, yes, Telltale Henry, love. Lots of tension there. And, like you said, Paige is asking all these questions, and I'm like, you are spot on. Why hasn't anybody else asked those questions?
And this is, I think, another instance of the show depicting the combination of Paige's naivete with her indoctrination, both explicit and especially implicit conditioning-wise, into the spy life and how those two things mix together, right? It's actually her position of being more naive that enables her to ask these more direct questions that are nonetheless informed by what she has been told, what she hasn't been told, and what, like, subliminal training her parents had been giving her entire life up until the point of the reveal. All those things come together and her multiple sets of questions that she's posing, like hard confrontational questions that she's posing to her parents.
I'm laughing a little bit because, like, thinking about her, like, her being naive, or, like, another way to think about it, right, is vis-a-vis this, Paige is the simple one, right? Like, But the thing that jumped to my brain was, like, Passover and the Passover Seder and, like, the four questions. And it's the simple one that asks the questions because, like, the simple child doesn't understand, like, what's going on, and so is asking questions as a means to understand. And that's, like, very much the role that Paige is in here. And, like, we know, as the audience, we know more than Paige, right? Because, like, we've been clued into what's up with Philip and Elizabeth in general, but also, like, where the Paige of it all fits in. And so, like, she's the only character that can ask these questions. Henry can't even ask these questions because he doesn't know how to, he wouldn't even know what question to ask.
Yeah.
There's a whole, like, Passover Seder reading of the Americans, but I'm gonna stop there.
Is that for the Patreon? JMO.
Fuck JMO. Well, I think this is a good place to jump back to the other idea that you put out there, that idea of Paige's sense of self and the way that that comes up in the earlier conversation, or the questions that get raised around that in the earlier conversation, and how that comes back both in this conversation and then the conversation at the end, which I think also does some work. And I'm specifically thinking about where Paige is like, well, when are you going to tell Henry? And Elizabeth's like, well, we, like, tell him. That depends on Henry. And I think that tells us something about, not necessarily just about Paige, but about the ways in which Philip and Elizabeth view Paige's, like, process of becoming spy and, like, and the role of, like, her changing construction of self in and through that, like, process.
I agree. And one of the things that I love about this particular episode is how Holly Taylor acts the full spectrum of Paige's sense of self, or the obstacles to her developing any sense of self whatsoever, because there are, and I think we even see that in, like, scene to scene basis with Alice, and then, and that contrasted with that final scene with her parents, because, like, there's a way in which Holly Taylor plays her interactions, Paige's interactions with Alice, as if she is, like, being, she is, like, the ventriloquist dummy for her parents. Like, she is performing the mission that her parents have explicitly told her to perform, or that she knows that her parents would want her to perform.
Yeah.
And I think, like, that is captured most vividly by, she's back in the rectory or whatever with, has a private moment with Alice, like, maybe about a third of the way through the episode. And it starts with Paige being the one who's, like, trying to, like, seek comfort or solace or something from Alice. And there's this role reversal where Alice says, like, I'm just so scared.
Yeah.
And gives this, like, incredibly heavy cry. And as that happens, the camera zooms in on Holly Taylor's extremely conflicted face.
Yeah.
And so it's like we see all of that role confusion or sense of self confusion on her face in that moment. And then there's, like, this partial shift that happens when she has a, like, position of, I know what I'm doing by, like, bringing Matthew to the church, which is like a flex in addition to all the other things yeah. that it is. And then Pastor Tim, it turns out, like, is alive and has been found. Then she has a very different kind of moment with Alice that's, like, both genuine but also a little bit Paige, like, feeling herself and being in control. At least that's how I read that scene.
That's how I read it, too.
Transition into the scene that you called our attention to, where she starts off, or more or less starts off that conversation with Elizabeth and Philip to say, I didn't end up asking her about the tape for this reason and that reason and this other reason. And Elizabeth is, like, I think impressed at yeah. the depth of spy thinking
yeah.
that Paige articulated in this moment of crisis. So there's just, like, all these different versions of Paige trying to find or, like, map out or chart her sense of self in just these couple of scenes in the storyline.
I think that that's right. And I think, like, where at least the way that I had a lot of similar readings of Paige, and Holly Taylor's acting is just, like, top tier in, like, face acting is on par with
Matthew Hayes
with Elizabeth, who's also, like, Carrie Russell is also often, like, doing a lot of face acting, right? Like,
oh, we're gonna get there.
So great. But I think the place where I came to by the conversation at the end is that we have been watching, at least over the last couple of episodes, right? Like, we've been watching Philip and Elizabeth struggle with who Paige is as a spy, Paige being a spy. Like, that has been a struggle. It's obviously also been a struggle for Paige, who, like, is sort of, like, begrudgingly engaging in these activities that her parents are like, no, yeah. no, you, like, have to do that for our own survival. And I think the final scene, the scene between the scene where, like, they're talking about telling Henry and all of that, I think that is where Paige is like, okay, I'm in this. I'm doing this. And I've, like, I have not necessarily agency in terms of getting myself into all of this, but now I have agency in how I do this. And I get to make some decisions about this, even if I didn't make full decisions to get here.
It's a good point, and it builds on a scene from the previous episode where she comes back in the opening scene of driving lessons with Philip and, like, gives yeah. a similar, it's really important that you be there at this farewell party for Tim, and here's why, for spy reasons. So there's, like,
yeah.
that happening. And I think, and if I may both end this one, Danielle, is
of
not
course,
acceptable.
Please.
Like, there's that utter, that is, there is that sense of self-ownership or self-possession and, like, I'm a spy too, which gets encouraged by Philip and Elizabeth, right? They say the hardest thing that we do is trust people. Dad and I tell each other the truth, and you're a part of that. And then Philip follows that up with a, we won't lie to you. So yes, that's a Paige, like, yeah. achieving and, like, reaching a new status or a new level in her spy speed run. But, like, it's also a lie, like, because they have and will continue to lie, because, like, there's not an explicit denial that they kill and disappear people. But, like, what happened in the previous several episodes, you know, people just keep every, you know, it's a recurring, people get killed and get made to disappear by Philip and Elizabeth. So there's, like, this, there's this, you know, further entrapment of Paige that
yeah.
is capitalizing on her sense of self that is trying to develop.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And then also, like, I might have just decided that this is what they said, but I feel like Elizabeth says a version of, or one of them says a version of, like, we're not going to be able to tell you everything, but we'll tell you as yeah. much as we can, which I took
yeah, yeah.
that
one
to,
of them does say that. Yeah.
So I took that to be like, we're not going to tell you we don't do things that we do, but we're not going to tell you everything we do. And like,
what do you think if Paige in that moment said, have you ever killed anybody or have you ever made anybody disappear? How do you think they would have answered that question?
I think they say, like, it doesn't make sense for us to answer that question. Like, some version of, if we give you an answer to that question, it puts you in more danger than you're already in.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's legit. Which Paige would then, I think, understand what that meant.
Listen, if this girl doesn't understand that her parents kill people already, like, she's crazy. And she does, right? Like, that's exactly why she says the thing to them initially, like, did you do this?
Is there any way?
Yeah. Right? Like, because, like, at least in her bones, even if no one has told her, she knows that that is, like, in the realm of possibility.
No notes.
Let's go to the next thing.
Please, let's do.
Let's talk a little bit about Elizabeth, Dawn, and Younghee, and, like, some of the exchanges around, like, that. I wouldn't call this a threat matrix. I would call this, like, an emotion cesspool.
Sadness.
Yeah.
Sadness cesspool, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially for Elizabeth. And this is a different side of Elizabeth than we maybe have ever gotten, question mark.
Like, yeah.
I think it's fair to say that Elizabeth as a character is more visibly distraught over what she has done and is about to further do to Dawn and Younghee and the kids than she was over her mom's death. Right? Is that, like, wild for me to say?
No, I don't think so, because I think that... her relationship with Younghee took her by surprise, right? And I don't think, like, her mom's death is a surprising thing. It's a hard thing, but it's not a surprising thing.
That's the relevant distinction, yeah.
Right, and Elizabeth's not good at being taken by surprise.
This is very true. And, like, I think your point that she's taken by surprise is a really necessary one, because, like, to obnoxiously, like, hit our theme over the head.
Love.
It's like she has entrapped herself in the process of entrapping Dawn / Younghee. Because, like, she's used this building of what is ostensibly a superficial friendship in order to get to Dawn. But then at the point at which it is the most genuine friendship she has maybe ever had with somebody that is not Philip in her life, question mark.
Yeah.
Like, it's just... she's played herself, right? And she knows that.
Yeah.
And Gabriel knows that. And Philip knows that. And in this, they're back to having Scrabble and Tease. There's been, like, enough rapprochement between the three of them to, like, come back and hang out and play some Scrabble together. They try to give Elizabeth an out. She doesn't want to take it. It's worth noting there that, like, Elizabeth is doing domestic labor while the dudes are sitting there, like, playing a game. And there's, like, something happening there that maybe is, like, symbolic of that. And then it's, like, over the course of the episode, presumably partly in response to what's happening with Alice and what's happening with Paige, by the end of the episode, Elizabeth is like, yeah, let's put this on pause at least a day or two,
but it's
to ask the center.
It's still really hard for her to say yes.
Yes,
and
it's
I
so
was
hard
expecting
for
her to say no, and I was like, "This is a triumph that she says yes." But I was certainly expecting her to say no, and, like, her face is trying to say no, right? Her body is trying to say no, and she can't. She says no the first time, and then Gabriel, like, doubles down and is like, "I mean, there's another way to do, like, we can at least ask, and, like, I'm going to ask before, you know, before we go through with the, like, final part of this." And
then, which Elizabeth identifies as the hardest part.
Right. And that's when she finally agrees to it. But, like, it's, like, under pain of death, right? Like, he has to, like, drag it out of her, basically.
And yes, and it's a brilliant Carrie Russell performance.
Totally.
Because you see in Carrie Russell's face after Elizabeth, like, quietly and softly gets the yes out, you can see that she is surprised, to your point, and, like, can't believe she said yes. Like, that's what I think Carrie Russell is giving us, is that Elizabeth can't believe she said yes that one time.
It's like... that she can't believe she said yes, but also, like, that she can't believe she let herself say yes.
Right?
Like, it's that, which is, like, she wanted to say yes, but she also wants to say yes to plenty of things and doesn't allow herself to do that.
Yeah. And it's a notable Gabriel moment that he, like, prods her into that yes in certain ways.
Yeah.
With a very different version of Gabriel than we've gotten for most of season four. And a very different Gabriel than we saw two episodes ago when he's talking with Claudia. Like, he is doing, like, feeling emotions talk in this episode. And then this scene with Elizabeth. Like, it's okay. Feelings can matter sometime. Like, the things that we do are hard. Like, you know, it's possible for people like us to, like, forget about ourselves. He's doing a, like, different kind of emotional caretaking than he usually does, or than he maybe even deeply believes at his core.
I mean, like, yes, I agree with that. And also, this is after he, like, does an about face and is like, it needs to be easier for you guys. Like, we have been putting too much on you, right? Like, this is after he's like, let's, like, take our foot off the gas because, like, things have gotten crazy. So it feels consistent with that version of Gabriel, which itself felt like we had to go through multiple seasons of him being a hard ass. And I do think that, like, if it were Philip being the one who was emotional about something, I don't think that this would have been his response. I think it's because it's Elizabeth and he identifies with Elizabeth and he knows, like, how hard line she is. And the fact that it's difficult for her means something significant.
Right. He knows he's not going to be, like, trapped by Philip into, like, this soft, you know, girly shit.
Exactly.
As I think how he would understand it, at least subconsciously. And I think it's, you know, a scene that we haven't talked about, which I think has been, like, hovering over the discussion of Paige and the discussion of Elizabeth, is actually the, like, parable that Philip gives of his parents and his mother
particular,
and Tobolsk, right? But, like, everything is hard. Like, everyone worked hard. Like, my dad was a logger in the forest outside of Tobolsk, right? While Paige is cooking, it's notably. And, like, everyone worked hard to provide for the family. I did so myself, and my mother was tough and all of that. And there's a way in which it's unclear, like, how I think we're meant to read Elizabeth vis-a-vis the, like, story that Philip is telling with regards to, like, Elizabeth's choices in this episode.
Well, I think, like, the way that Paige receives Elizabeth is, like, Philip's mother, right? But this episode reveals to us, and, like, this is something we have known at least through the Young-He relationship over the course of the last couple of episodes, like, we know that Elizabeth is not just tough. There's also, like, emotional, like, layers and substance there. But the way that she presents herself most often to Paige and to others is, like, you know, like a steel trap.
One thing that the editing does to, I think, play with that particular dynamic is there, and this is picking up on a bunch of stuff that happened in episode 9 that we talked about, like, what are the scenes that are being cut back and forth between, like, or what are the, you know, in the same sequence? And here it's that story that Philip tells about his mom and his dad and Tobolsk with Elizabeth having the awkward dinner with the Seong family. We particularly get that look on Elizabeth's face as she hugs Young-hee and then turns away towards the camera.
Yeah.
And she's just utterly crushed. So it's, like, a little bit also the, what are the emotional tolls or emotional costs of being that, like, tough, hardworking, protective mother Russia figure.
Yeah, and part of it is that, one, you don't know how to have friends, and two, when you do let someone in a real way, you sort of, like, your sense of self is a little bit shattered, which feels like part of what Elizabeth is going through is a kind of shattering of herself, having to make all these choices that I think, like, a year ago or, you know, 10 years ago in her life, like, it wouldn't have been hard to make these choices and and now it's hard. And that, I think, like, as we are seeing Paige, like, come into herself, I think we're seeing Elizabeth leave the version of herself that she has, like, cemented for so long.
It's a mark of the show, I think, to be able to deepen Elizabeth's character in this particular way.
Yeah.
Without it becoming, like, too cliched or too easy, because it's not as if Elizabeth has lost any of her hard-ass do-it-for-the-homeland persona or feelings. It's more just a, complexification and expansion of all of those. Sorry, the cat is knocking pens off of the desk while we record.
It's almost like our relationships with other people alter the ways in which we exist in the world.
And the ways that emotions circulate?
Possibly.
My God.
It's as though there's a feminist theory of power even within the Americans. That's for the real ones. Anything else on, like, the Elizabeth Younghee Don triumvirate?
No, I think we go to the last attempted entrapment, we might say, of this episode.
Yeah, so I think we wanted to end our discussion of entrapment anyway with the attempted entrapment of Gad and, like, his subsequent death. Like, RIP Gad.
Fuck, man.
I was sad about this. And also, I said this to you before, I cannot believe that Arcadi authorized, like, whatever bonkers mission this was. To send these idiots, the Munchkins, into like, try to turn Gad? Come on, man.
The true Munchkins are the Russians we sent to Thailand along the way.
I'm sorry. You really think that this dude, who, like, was what seemed like contemplating suicide over the fact that he did not, like, catch, like, that Martha was the mole, the spy, whatever, and now we're gonna try to turn him? Come on, man. What the fuck?
Yeah, like, I'm not sure if I wish we got this, because, like, there's a way in which this works to just be so abrupt in the end, and I say that because there's an abruptness from a narrative perspective to Gad's storyline that mirrors the abruptness and, like, pratfall that leads to his death, like, his actual death, like, impaled on a window shard in his hotel room. But regardless, like, what did Arcadi and the center, like, actually think they were going to be able to get out of Gad? I don't know. Like, I obviously, he knows all of the counterintelligence secrets, and they don't have somebody, as far as we know, like, in place in that division or whatever. But it seems like such a long shot that can go wrong in so many ways. So, like, there's that question that I think is, like, maybe what speaks to your skepticism about, like, why did Arcadi, like, think this was a reasonable idea in the first place? Then there's also the risk that this runs.
Yes.
Because it's like they made a point, the show The Americans made a point of, in the previously on, voiced by Gad, I would note.
Yeah.
Of showing the mention that Stan makes to Philip that Gad is on his way to Thailand, which, like, obviously is the direct explanation for how they know to track him down in Thailand, but also is, like, if Stan is really good at his job, could he put one and one and one and one and one and one together to, like, add to his, to, like, create some suspicion? And I mean, like,
no,
he puts some of those together on his face in that scene in the vault with Adderholt, but, you know, seemingly not all of them.
I don't think that Stan, I mean, listen, Stan has not yet figured out that Philip and Elizabeth are literal spies. So I don't think that he's going to be like, oh, I mentioned it to my neighbor while I was, like, sad boying about and in his house or whatever.
Like, at the racquetball court.
Oh, that's right. It's at the racquetball court. It's also like, if Stan said it to Philip, how many other people did Stan say it to, and who else might have known? I just, like, He doesn't have the tools. He doesn't have the tools.
So a question then in response to that, Danielle.
Okay.
Why do you think the creators behind the show put this in this particular episode? You know I love this question.
I know. You do love questions like this. I think that part of it is there's something about the fact that, like, the center was able to extract Martha that, like, shows how competent the center is and how competent they all are. And I think we needed a version of, like, oh, no, they're not. Or, like, everybody fucks up. And so, like, I think there was, like, some kind of balance that needed to happen now. I don't know that killing Gad is the way that I would have gone with that, but...
I mean, they weren't trying to kill him, right? Like, they didn't want to kill him, so...
Yeah, but I feel like... I can't get over the idiocy of this move. It just, like, feels very dumb. But I do feel like there is a... There's something about the misstep of going to Gad and trying to, like, recruit him or entrap him that reveals a kind of...
Hubris
or, like, misjudgment that the center is. And like, I would also say that they have misjudged, like, the children of spies, right? Like, they misjudged Paige. They misjudged the other dude who killed everybody, you know?
Yeah, they sure did.
So I think this is...
And fucked his handler, started fucking his handler.
Yeah, like, I think this is another reminder of that, like... Like, the center, like, or the powers that be, like, they get it wrong, too.
I really like that reading of why it's in this episode, because I think it fits it within the context of the season really effectively and helps explain, like, part of why it's so abrupt, including that we get this emotional note with Gad and Stan,
yeah,
like, at the end of two episodes ago after they make the time jump. And then I think the other reason it shows up in this episode is that it... Both and gives justification and lie to the KGB could have killed Pastor Tim secretly in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like it proves that they can track and get to somebody in another country. And A, so maybe they could have done it. And B, they're such bumbling fuck-ups that there's no way they could possibly pull off something this complicated.
Right, because they send these goons in to do it.
More about the goons later. One note about that scene, though, there's, like, an interesting linguistic thing that's happening with regards to how they address Gad, particularly when he's, like, bleeding out on the fucking floor.
Okay.
That, like, there's a shifting back and forth in the Russian between the, like, informal second person and formal second person that I just thought was notable.
And with that, I think we have finished the main discussion.
Danielle, I'm not interested in pursuing that one.
Well, I just, like, I don't have anything to say about Russian.
Fair.
And it's time to move on.
And you do love the dossier.
I love the dossier. And I think, like, we ended the main discussion with Gad, so let's start the dossier with Gad. I'm going to take this as a half win.
Okay, say more.
I feel like I predicted Gad's impending death. Now, did I think it was going to be a suicide? Yes, I did. Was it? No, it was not.
Or a heart attack. Didn't you also theorize heart attack?
Yeah, I also thought, like, maybe heart attack. This was neither of those things, but Gad is gone, so I'm taking it as a win.
I'll allow it. This is a tough game, so I'll allow it.
Pastor Tim.
Like, I just want to express my eternal gratitude that, like, you have to do this week after week or, like, every other day after every other day during the
really
break.
It is.
And, like, I just get to sit here and, like, know what happens.
Listen, you're doing a great job not giving away what happens. So, like, I'll take my burden.
I've only had one major failure in dossier things, but that's okay.
It's okay.
Happened earlier in season four for the real heads, if they know what I'm talking about.
I want to talk about Pastor Tim very briefly.
Please.
Snatch back.
We'll talk about him forever.
No. This is quick. Pastor Tim snatched back into life from the jaws of death. Where you're forcing me to take this as a loss. But like
correct.
I said, until the credits roll on the last episode of this series and Pastor Tim is still alive, I will not take the L.
Okay. So the prediction remains dead at hands of KGB in some form?
I mean, I just sort of feel that, like, Alice has put her cards on the table, and, like, I just don't know. They got to do something. Like, I need them to do something.
Sure.
It's not past, and, like, and there's the impending, like, oh, we have to have this conversation. Like, that's still out there. Like, listen, Pastor Tim, still alive, but it is what it is. In terms of entrapment, something that I think might come back to be a form of entrapment later on is Tatiana revealing to Oleg that she is, like, in this covert unit nonsense. I just feel like somewhere down the road, that's going to come into play in a way that's going to split or like, challenge Oleg's allegiance.
Regardless of whether this comes true or not, it's a nice prediction because the episode does call our attention to the fact that Tatiana tells Oleg, you can't tell Makati that you know.
Right.
So, which, like, the split allegiance is, like, you know, your bro or your new girlfriend.
Right. Exactly. Last thing, I think Paige and Matthew are going to bang.
Okay. Now, by bang, you mean fuck, or bang, you mean, like, chase, make out?
No, fuck. They're going to go to the bone zone. Oh, my God.
Okay. I mean, one more episode of someone going to the bone zone is in the dossier, and then all of a sudden, every single episode has to include these two characters go to the bone zone prediction.
Listen, so
tread carefully, Danielle Hanley.
When Matthew was like, do you want to come in? I was like, is Paige going to lose her virginity? Like, what's happening here? Is this like Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Is he going to turn into like a mean vampire again? Like, where are we?
Great reference.
I know. All right, let's go to Gloss.
Yeah.
We ended the dossier with Paige and Matthew. Let's start with Paige and Matthew in Gloss. What do you got for us?
It's such a weird, awkward, but I think intentionally weird and awkward entree into this scene, because Paige, like, has this halting, I was looking for Henry, but I guess he's at Doug's, and Matthew's just like, well, do you want to hang out? Like, my dad's working all weekend and not paying attention. Paige then, like, makes an awkward joke about, well, you're not very big on interior decorating. But then that, which is a decent joke, and then, like, it turns into a, like, kind of real conversation, because they, like, get into,
yeah,
like, Matthew's dad being in the FBI and what that feels like for Matthew. So, like, this is also Paige developing and articulating, like, her skills as a budding spy, as becoming spy, where she, like, knows this question, or, like, her intuits that this is the right question to ask to, like, elicit an actual genuine response from Matthew, which I think is notable. And Matthew's like, yeah, like, it's pretty cool that now my dad, like, you know, tells me a little bit about what's happening at work. Yeah. And so, like, there's a lot that's happening in the moment between the two of them.
Well, and he's like, I can drive you. I can drive you to church.
Yeah.
Listen, no one's driving you to church that doesn't want to fuck you.
Love that. What is a euphemism for the bone zone? If not, like, can I drive you to church?
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't know. There's so much that I love about this particular scene. Like, the jokes about Paige drinking coffee and, like, taking her coffee black, and, like, she is sad and fucked up and exhausted. Like, then that gets called attention to here. There's just a lot. And there's a editing choice to have this scene come immediately after the scene of Philip and Kimmy,
yeah,
that I also think is notable, because, like, there's a much different, but there's, like, older man, younger teen woman thing that's happening, and, like, there's just a lot going on there.
Well, I think also, like, Matthew is talking about his father and the way that the relationship with his father has shifted. Like, Paige is obviously experiencing all of these shifts with her parents, and then, like, the Philip and Kimmy conversation is around Kimmy's relationship with her father, right? And that's, like, the advice that he's giving her, which is, like, wild. And so there's some real, like, transference stuff happening across all of these pieces.
Not to mention that Matthew gives Paige another piece of the people get fucking disappeared by spies puzzle.
Yep.
And what he says about what his dad has revealed to him about work. And then there's just the awkward as fuck interactions at the church itself.
I can't.
So, like, if they were on the, like, path trajectory towards the bone zone, like, that was a detour. no offense to your theory that you don't take anybody to church unless you want to fuck them.
You don't drive anybody to church. I'm not saying inside the church is where the fucking happens.
So you go to the parking lot and bone zone in the parking lot, but once you enter the church, like, we're in a different realm.
I feel like you're taking this too literally. I'm the metaphorical act of Matthew being like, I'll drive you, is him being like, I would like to sleep with you. It's not like we are going to sleep with each other at the church today. It is like laying the tracks to ride on that train. All right, let's go to Philip and Kimmy.
Okay, I got more to say about that church scene. We'll get there.
I don't want you to say any more about the church scene. I'm done with it. Kimmy back.
There's Kimmy back, which I love because I think that these scenes are always just, like, totally fascinating and also, like, prefigures Julia Garner's, like, later career success and triumph and stardom and all of that. But one of the things that I thought was most notable about this, and it builds on a point that you just made about the transition from this scene into Paige and Matthew, This is like some extreme actual parenting by Philip and like a very non-like the character of James way.
I fully agree. This felt like a real departure from the version of James that we had encountered, except that the place where my brain went was, I guess, one of the last times we saw them interact was when, like, Philip was like, oh, like, my son, let's pray for him, blah, blah, like, let's pray. And so I wonder if, like, there is some continuity with the, like, I'm struggling with the stuff with my son and I'm always thinking about him. And now I'm, like, imparting this wisdom to you about your dad.
I like that reading of it. I also like that reading of it because there's both the genuineness of this point with her dad, Isaac Breland, which is all, of course, for Philip about, like, what is his relationship with Paige, as you pointed out. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this weird stuff, and, like, maybe this is prefiguring some Matthew things, I don't know, where they, like, talk about Kimmy's, like, boyfriend or quasi-boyfriend or situationship or whatever. Pete. Just a classic one-syllable white man name.
Exactly.
And, like, there's just the awkwardness that Philip has his disguised character of Jim perform in that moment that I thought was fascinating to me. Like, Kimmy is stoned out of her mind, making owl sounds, like true ooh, queen for Danielle.
Ooh, ooh. I love an owl. John and I have matching owl tattoos.
I raised our owl in salute at Kimmy in that moment. And it's a shot that's framed really beautifully. Like, there at one point is a zoom out to, like, a little bit more of a middle distance shot with them, like, on the chairs or on the bench, I guess, not chairs, on the porch, like, framed by these Victorian windows that I thought was just really beautiful.
Yeah, and I just, like, there's a kind of calmness, obviously, because they're stoned, but there's a kind of calmness at the Breland house that, like, does not exist at Phillips. And so there's, like, that that felt like a kind of pause in the episode.
Because he's a pot connoisseur, Daniel.
You always have the best pot.
I think we could ask the same question here, Danielle, that we asked of the scene with Gad, which is, why is Kimmy back in this particular episode? Mm-hmm. And, like, why have this scene in this episode? And I think the line that you drew between Kimmy and Paige, I think goes a long way towards answering that particular question. Like, there's a sense in which this question about, like, what's the relationship with your father, who has a secret identity that is different than his actual identity, that, like, situates it familially and, like, thematically and emotionally into Paige's arc and sense of self, as we've talked about it.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And like, I like that you've connected it back to, like, Paige's sense of self, because it seems I am always thinking about Paige and Kimmy sort of, like, vis-a-vis one another. And so that connection makes sense to me, too.
And Kimmy is much more, like, put together in terms of her sense of self and, like, self-possessed in this episode than when we saw her in seasons 2 and 3.
Should we go to Oleg and Tatiana?
Let's do it.
Again, like we said, Tatiana's like, I'm part of this, like, covert unit. I guess the way that she says it is, like, have you figured out why it is what it is I'm doing and why it is I'm here? And it's like, what weird pillow talk.
But, like, what great pillow talk, because they, once again, just some, like, incredible sex between Oleg and Tatiana. This is just, like, one of the funniest character pairings that they have come up with, and just, like, sources of pure humor, because there's, like, Oleg's satisfaction at the fact that now Tatiana is, like, being somewhat loud, yeah, and having sex, I think it's safe to say. And, like, Oleg playfully is like, shh, you can't do this, which is hilarious. Then there's Oleg in, like, post-sex euphoria, like, going on and on about Twinkies and how you can't understand America without trying a Twinkie. And, like, it's just utterly ridiculous. And at the same time, to your point, an extremely serious, yeah, conversation of pillow talk that they get into. So just, like, get you someone who can do both. Like, both weird playful sex stuff and we're gonna destroy the world with biological weapons.
I mean, no notes. I will just say I'm totally on board with Oleg's Twinkie theory, which is like there it reveals something fundamental about America. Fully agree.
Yeah. There's like these funny jokes about, well, why do you need a female computer expert, 50 to 60 perfect English? You know, which opens up the have you gotten to why we're here. Then I think the single funniest line of the entire episode comes from Tatiana, where she's like, oh, yeah, it's really hard to figure out the biological weapon stuff. It's like full military security. But, and then she laughs, they can't stop being American, so they give some of it to a private subcontractor, and we got someone in there. It's like, that is pure, like, capitalism is bullshit, Soviet humor.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Really shining through Tatiana. Brilliant shining moment of the episode.
I liked that joke. I was like, ooh, you nailed it. Oleg's Twinkie line and Tatiana's, like, they can't stop being Americans. I was like, no notes. This is brilliant.
Yeah. We love this.
Love.
So, Danielle, why is this episode called Munchkins?
I mean, to me, it's called the Munchkins because those are the idiots they send to deal with Gad. And it's like,
I like that.
Like, we represent the Lollipop Guild, the Lollipop Guild, the Lollipop Guild.
Yes, she did it.
We wish to welcome you to Munchkin Land. Can I recite the entirety of The Wizard of Oz, like, start to finish with no source material? Why, yes, yes, I can. I can also cite the entirety of Return to Oz, my favorite movie as a child.
For the Patreon, for $100 an episode, you get a personal rehearsal.
Just Danielle reciting the lines and singing the songs.
Yes, exactly.
In Return to Oz, there's a whole weird thing where it's like the Gnome King is afraid of eggs and chickens. Unclear why.
Is that when you call in Becky to sing the egg song in the middle of your performance?
Eggs. It goes on, but I'll stop there.
Yeah, I love it. I think that's the best answer to, like, why else beyond the obvious, like, this is the derogatory nickname for Wolf, the new head of counterintelligence, and, like, his crew.
Yeah.
The Americans fandom wiki, like, gives the, like, Oz is about, like, a childhood innocence, loss of childhood innocence dynamic, and, like, so we're calling or referencing or evoking that with the Munchkins title, which I think seems plausible, with, like, how we think about Paige. The Americans wiki also points to the fact that, like, we get the question about, like, what does Henry know and not know, like, which is kind of a, like, is he a child or is he on the way to adult? So that makes sense to me. It checks out, I think.
Yeah, but the Munchkins are not children.
No, I know.
I know. That's the part of it that I'm bothered by.
I think it's general, like, childhood innocence, Wizard of Oz, not specifically, like, the Munchkins are children or not children. I think you're taking it a little bit too literally, Daniel.
I'm just angry that they've, like, misused the name.
Well, I think they missed a great opportunity that we provided, which is they should have called this episode Entrapment in Munchkinland.
You know what? Yes. Agree.
Could you write that song, Entrapment in Munchkinland?
It's going to take me a couple of episodes, but come back to me. That'll also be on the Patreon. Okay, let's get to some of the minor notes.
Yeah, I just love Arcadi's office so much. I feel like it's been a few episodes since we've gotten some time to hang out there. Like the furniture, like the dark walls, the decor, the like rich greens that are in this, the wood, the paneling that's in this. I just wish that set was like my office.
I agree. Beautiful, beautiful office. And just like feels very official when we're in there.
It does. They're always emphasizing like the many different sub like mini spaces within this large office. And like there's a contrast, I think, to be made between the opulence of Arcadi's office and the like tiny, cramped, bureaucratic like nothingness, like sterility of what was Gad's and is now Wolf's office.
Agree.
Cool.
What else?
I mean, as you referenced earlier, Carrie Russell's like, are you fucking kidding me face? Yeah. Or like, are you going to finish that point face? Or do you really want to go there face? There's lots of names we could give it. All of it extremely on point in this episode. Like, just over and over again when Paige is like, are we really sure? Is there any way? And Elizabeth keeps giving her a stronger and stronger version of that face. Just another like poignant but also laugh moment of the Americans.
Yeah, Carrie Russell, amazing face acting for sure.
Yeah, and Philip gets a like banging black turtleneck in this episode. Way more stylish than what I understand the turtlenecks of the 80s to actually be, but good job, Matthew Reese, for getting your character a slightly more stylish costume here.
I wore so many turtlenecks in the 80s, like so many.
Yeah, I mean, put a turtleneck on like a young child. Like, I think that's a classic move.
Well, it's like there are all these pictures in my parents' house, like old school pictures of me in like a vest and a turtleneck multiple years in a row. So I'm with.
That's remembered nostalgia for the 80s.
Fair. It's only
lived nostalgia.
It's only fitting to end borrowed nostalgia with, or end Gloss with a little bit of remembered nostalgia before we go to borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s.
Yes, Danielle, I think you have a thesis to give us on Alice. Ugh.
Hair and dress choices are just like the worst 80s of it all. First of all, her hair choice feels like a 70s hair choice, which makes me angry. Mm.
Okay.
And the dresses are like adult versions of things that my mom bought for us at a flea market that we then had to like wear at Christmas Eve when we were younger.
Oh my God. This is such a shared smooth brain moment because like I have in my notes, what is this? These dress, I cannot with these dresses. Is Alice doing Christian twee? Right? It's Christian twee. I think that's an accurate description of these fucking dresses and the bows. Yes.
Yeah. But like, this was what people wore in the 80s. Like, and adults wore these things too, which is the like problem. It's one thing if you're like a kid, like I have this dress that looked very similar to Alice's dress, but it had like ABC on the bib and we called it the alphabet dress.
Yeah.
As one does. And so like a 4-year-old in the alphabet dress makes sense. Alice is just wearing like an aged up version. She looks like a 1970s American doll, but like that she got the like people clothing that you could get and like match your American girl doll.
Like, what a read, like gone. The dresses don't exist anymore. They've been ethered into non-existence by Danielle.
You're welcome.
Yeah. I didn't even know that's what I wanted. Thank you.
What's next?
I don't know. There's something about the like extended joke about Paige drinking coffee and like teens, they be drinking coffee like that was funny in the 80s when now like don't all teens like get Starbucks? Like,
when was the first time you had a cup of coffee? How old were you?
First time I had a cup of coffee. I mean, I was probably, I forget if it was a summer or a winter break where I was like working at like a catering, like deli situation.
Sophomore in
college. Like probably like 17, maybe.
Sophomore in 18. College. And remember that I went to swim practice at like 5:30 every morning before high school. Never had any coffee. Sophomore year in college, I like started drinking vanilla lattes.
Nice. Nice. And now I have a chemical dependency on caffeine.
I will say John came to visit in the summer and I like had not quite realized how intense your coffee addiction is. And it was like, oh, no. Like, do you have coffee in your house for like when I wake up? And I was like, I mean, I have this like weird like instant coffee. And you're like, that's fine. I just need to like put this in my body. I was like, okay.
It's a joke, but also not a joke. I'm like chemically dependent on caffeine. I do like literally have to like, when traveling, like think ahead to how I'm going to get enough caffeine intake on a daily basis.
I'm definitely addicted to caffeine.
In the right pattern of hours throughout the day and quantity. So like, that's not great. That's not how you want to be doing it.
No, but we can laugh at Paige's, like, I need coffee and like leave our own dependencies aside.
Thank you. But yeah, the jokes about it, something about that screamed 80s to me.
I'll take it.
80s humor. Wolf hands Adderall back this like manila folder of documents and is like, check your margins. And that was just hilarious to me.
I struggled because there was so much going on in this episode. I struggled to like keep the pieces of the plot straight. So I wasn't paying attention to the 80s-ness beyond the egregious, obviously, 80s of Alice's choices.
Yeah. Kitchenware in this episode, particularly like the like weird plastic water jug, like it's not a Brita filter, it's like just a pitcher and it's an ugly color of yellow brown.
Yeah.
And it's got a plastic like clear ish, but dirty enough to not be to be like somewhat opaque plastic lid. That's 80s and 90s.
Yeah, we had
plenty of those growing up for sure.
We had it, but it was like we had taken it from my grandparents who definitely had it in the 80s.
Ours was like the ugliest possible light blue color that exists in plastic.
Ours was like a version of the one that they had. It was like a weird yellow and a weird brown. And there also were these like other plastic mugs that went along with it that my grandmother would make pudding in, but like not the instant pudding, the kind that like has a film that it's like very gross.
Gad's aftershave routine is like 80s, but also like the 50s extremely, where like he finishes shaving. And the 80s part of it is he has an electric razor, right?
Yeah.
He's like got his Norelco or whatever. And then he like puts some aftershave and like slaps himself all over his face. And like men be doing aftershave is extremely 80s to me. Although I'm sure that lots of people do aftershave in the 2020s. I just like you have sensitive baby skin lotion when I shave. So and like,
fair.
Don't want to smell like musk. I also, that's not my goal in life.
I mean, yeah, I don't have any feelings on this, but it did feel, there was something about the like, just Gad has a like, I'm from the 50s, but in the 80s vibe to him. So like, I think I like your description.
Yeah, they have no Axe body spray available to them. Oof. Although Oleg would be the like male character in this show, and Henry, obviously. We know Henry overuses cologne.
Henry.
But like those two would be the ones to abuse Axe body spray, but which I mean having any of it come into contact with their skin.
100%. 100%.
Speaking of Henry, he's basically not around in this episode other than his telltale Henry. But we also get a reference to him having been listening to his Walkman is the reason why he couldn't hear exactly what Alice was yelling.
That they were spies.
She showed up. Yeah.
Listen.
Convenient use of a quintessential 80s and early 90s music device.
100%. 100%.
Lastly, we shouted it out above in gloss, and we're going to do it again here. Like, we're making jokes about how Reagan is fucking privatizing everything. It's the 80s. Like, Tatiana really bringing this point home to us. Whether we're talking about UK, whether we're talking about the US, like, a lot of the, like, Chile experimental violence stuff has happened a little bit earlier. Like, it's Reagan, Thatcher, neoliberalism, and, like, that includes privatizing a whole bunch of shit, and Tatiana is on the lookout for it and making jokes about it.
Listen.
That's 80s.
We love that she can that she can make jokes about, like, the forces that are literally killing humanity.
Yeah. And one other meta note on Bard Nostalgia, Danielle. We have a new fresh opportunity next week for you to discover the reference.
Oh, yeah, because we have a new guest.
Yeah. Who I don't think he's
gonna not
going to
know.
It's not his music vibe.
Oh, well, I guess we'll just make it to the end of the series and you'll have to tell me.
Dramatic reveal.
That and Pastor Tim finally dying.
Yeah, those are going to be the only two topics in our season 6 episode 13 pod.
Seems great. All right, let's go to minor character of the week.
We do love the minor characters of the week, Danielle. Who do we got this week?
The bumbling trio of idiots that try to, like, turn Gad. Only credited to is Russian man, Ilya Volo, Russian thug, Roman Blot. But, like...
Yeah, and the third one who doesn't... those two of them talk, if I remember correctly. I guess the third one doesn't get credited on IMDb. But, like, there are three of them. This is... like, the most the show has leaned into stereotypical caricatures of Russians in its existence thus far, I think.
I agree. And also, like, there was something, like, the minute they walked in, even before they said any words, I was like, these guys are Russian. I don't... something about the, like, oversized blazers.
It's the shirts. Yeah. It's the shirts. It's the... yeah, it's the clothing. It's the clothing for sure. But, yeah. And also, I just want to, like, shout out, Ilya Volok is, like, an incredible name and fun to say. Nice. So I'm... had to say it. We had to do it. Yeah. And I, Danielle, against your wishes, I'm going to offer a backup minor character of the week. We have... creepy as fuck, like, so cheery church bro Zach is our minor character of the week, played by David Spadora. A, gives sex pest vibes.
1,000,000%.
B, this is part of that. He could be, his character could be 16, 17. His character could be my age, 36. And both of those are equally plausible as far as I'm concerned.
But you know what was unnecessary? His character did not need to hug Paige. She came with a potential boyfriend. Why are you hugging her? Get out of here.
They're gonna talk about guitars and church choirs.
No, thank you.
But yeah, this is like creepy youth group, like, at its
core. Agree.
Is the character, minor character of Zach.
Agree.
Also, they named him fucking Zach. Like, come on.
Another one-syllable white dude name.
Be suspicious of us.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Yes. All right. Well, we have found ourselves once again in the cave.
Yes. And Danielle is continuing to thwart my cave dreams.
I rolled in and I was like, all right, we're going to do the Fado. John's like, I just want to do the Republic. I'm like, we got to change it up. We got to keep them guessing. John's like, I want to do no guessing. I just want to be in a new book of the Republic. Sorry.
But then Danielle pointed out that if we really wanted to change it up, we'd have to do book 10 of the Republic, and no one's got time
for that. No one wants to do that. The Fado is...
So I chose Fado, which I know nothing about except for, like, the two pages that depict the death of Socrates and have literally never read
it. A Cock for Asclepius, you mean? That's one of the lines from the last two pages.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Could I do those verbatim too? Why, yes, I could. Will I? No, thank you.
One day. That's my dream.
One day.
All right, Danielle. I'm scrolling through the Fado. You're going to have to tell me to stop at some point.
Okay, stop.
Okay. Will you give me a letter?
I mean, I think I always have to go D for Danielle.
Always going D for Danielle. All right, Danielle. We are in line 94D.
Okay.
We have, surprise, surprise, Socrates is saying some stuff. All right. Well, now, don't we find it, in fact, operating in just the opposite way, dominating all those alleged sources of its existence and opposing them in almost everything throughout all of life, mastering them in all kinds of ways, sometimes disciplining more harshly and painfully with gymnastics and medicine, sometimes more mildly, now threatening and now admonishing, conversing with our appetites and passions and fears as if it were a separate thing? That, surely, is the sort of thing Homer has represented in the Odyssey when he says that Odysseus, quote, striking his breast, reproved his heart with the words, "Endure, my heart, even worse thou didst once endure," end quote. Do you think he'd have composed that with the idea that the soul was attunement, the sort of thing that could be led by the feelings of the body rather than something that could lead and master them, being itself too far divine a thing to rank as attunement? 94 C through E of the Phaedo.
Listen, this is a weird dialogue.
Say more. Educate the listeners. I don't need to be educated. I know everything about the Phaedo. I don't need the context, and I definitely know exactly what the fuck Socrates is talking about.
I mean, I want to be very clear. I have no idea what Socrates is talking about, but that's like my general vibe is like I don't ever know what Socrates is talking about, but I can always like make a couple of twists and turns and find it. But this dialogue is primarily about like what happens to the soul after death. And it's like the dialogue begins by Phaedo saying like, aren't you afraid of dying? And Socrates is like, I'm a philosopher. Why would I be afraid of dying? Like, philosophers are interested in the unknown, and like what happens to the soul after death is unknown, right? And so it also earlier on in the dialogue, it's like they're talking about like what to do with Socrates, and he's sort of like, I will not be there. It's just my body. It won't be my soul. So like the soul for Socrates is like the important thing, and the body is like the casing for the soul.
Or sausage casing, yes.
You know, and so I feel like here, sort of in the discussion of attunement, in the discussion of the soul, it's like back in that like figuring out what happens to the soul or like attending to the soul is both like the science, it's like the science of philosophy, and also like precisely why the philosopher should not be afraid of death, because like in the pursuit of that which like we don't know, death is like the vast unknown, and the what happens to the soul in the vast unknown is like an exciting thing.
There's a way in which like this is speaking to, we joked about Book 10 of the Republic, and I don't teach Book 10 of the Republic.
Me neither.
Like obviously, like I'm assuming this is understood to be like a text written by quote unquote Plato that is most in like conversation with Book 10 of the Republic. But like there's also one of the parts I enjoy about teaching the Apology is at the very, very end when, the way I frame it to the class is like, you know, what is Socrates saying about death? And like, they actually usually get it pretty well. Mm-hmm. And then my summary is like, so he's saying it's one of two things. Like either it's the best fucking sleep you have ever had in your life. Like, or I get to go converse like in Hades with all of the great philosophers and poets and storytellers. So like it's a win-win for Socrates as he presents it at the end of the Apology. So what like you're giving us here is the like spin on that focuses so intensively on the soul.
Yeah, and I think like the mention of Odysseus here, right, is like similar to what's going on in Book 10, the sort of like going to the underworld, which is something that happens in the Odyssey. And so if I were to relate this to the Americans.
I've been waiting for you to do that because I don't fucking
I'm like, Pastor Tim dying? No, but like, I think.
Where does Pastor Tim's soul go, Daniel?
Not interested. But I do think that there's a way in which, like, the fear of death, right? Which is like so present for Alice, so present for Paige, but it's like not really present for Philip and Elizabeth. Like there's a kind of like, this is just like what we do. This is the quotidian going on of life. Like death is part of that. Of course, we've seen at various points, like them murdering people as being more challenging to them. But I think like there's something similar, at least in tone, with the way that Philip and Elizabeth, like, approach and engage the possibility of death. And Socrates is like, yeah, this is just, like, the next step. Like, we just got to deal with it. Like, we keep on going. The way the dialogue ends is that Socrates is like, you know, he takes the poison and he's like, I can't, like, I am, like, feel it in my legs. Like, he feels like a weightiness in his legs. And, like, yeah. His last line is, don't forget to sacrifice a cock to Asclepius. And there's, like, so much made about that line. Like, is this him, like, sacrificing to the god to thank him for dying? Is this, like, something, is there something else? There's, like, a whole Nietzschean, Straussian, like, reading of it. But I think there's, like, a general acceptance of death that Socrates is putting forward and trying to communicate to his students who are sort of surrounding him. And I think that same acceptance of death, or just, like, that this is a possibility, is something we get from Philip and Elizabeth and that other characters struggle with so profoundly.
Yeah, to pick up on, like, the Socrates point in particular and then go back to your Americans point, like, one of the things I've come to really enjoy doing when I teach the Crito is, like, so I don't do the death scene from Phaedo, mm-hmm. but I do have a spend some time after we're done talking about the Crito looking at and talking about the Jacques-Louis David painting, The Death of Socrates, and the students oftentimes, like, come up with some really cool ideas and interpretations of that painting, yeah. and, like, I don't use the term mimesis, but, like, my questions about that painting are often, like, how is, like, Jacques-Louis David as a painter, like, representing Socrates yeah. here at this moment of his death, and then the people around him, and, yeah, the finger in the air, right? Which is, like, a question about mimesis, mm-hmm. ultimately, even if I'm not using that term. So that's more the side note. But on the Americans part, like, the thing from the quote that we ended up on that, like, really struck me is this end part, right? This question about, like, the soul is attunement.
Yeah.
Could it be led by the feelings of the body, rather than is it something that could lead and master those feelings of the body? And, like, this reminds me of the end scene of this episode where Gabriel's like, actually, maybe we do occasionally get to have feelings yeah. that can matter sometime and, like, lead at least our decision-making with this, like, respite or pause that Elizabeth, you know, hesitatingly asks for.
I really like that. I wouldn't have necessarily, like, gotten there, but I really like bringing us back to, like, the Gabriel of it all and just, like, what feels like a slightly out of character offer to him, but, like, ultimately is probably, like, within the broader, like, mission as he sees it. And that's also how Socrates is thinking about, it's not that, like, the body or emotions are totally unimportant to Socrates, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. But they're, like, they always need to be understood, like in and through the relationship to the soul. And I feel like there's a version yes. of that with Gabriel too, which is like, we're going to recognize that emotions are important here and that your emotions in particular are important in this moment because they're telling us something important, but they're telling us something important about the, like, broader mission.
I agree. It's like Gabriel can logos away the, like, feelings
totally.
And the emotions that are happening in that moment. Yeah.
I think we have, like, conquered the Phaedo, and maybe let's get into some theory ships.
Great. Let's never do the Phaedo again. Who's our season 5 thinker going to be? We know we already made this joke last episode. Never mind.
That actually brings me quite nicely to my first theory ship, which is
a surprise. I don't know what this is. Usually these are in the notes, but I don't know what this is.
I wrote down surprise. My theory ship is Derrida, Plato's Pharmacy. Essay, because the idea of the pharmacon, which also, like, comes in, the pharmacon is, like, that reading is coming from, at least in part, the Phaedo, right? Because Socrates is like, oh, give me the pharmacon, which is the Greek word that both means medicine and poison. And so Plato's Pharmacy, as Derrida reads it, is, like, playing around with, like, the relationship between poison and medicine and how those are, like, two sides of the same coin, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I want to give that to Paige to read because it does feel like there's something about poison and medicine that will be profound to her.
I love that. Can I add on to that particular theory ship? Yeah. After she's done that, can we theory ship, like, Irigaray's, like, Plato's Hysteria to Paige 2 as a follow-up to the Pharmacon?
I'm always happy to give anybody Irigaray. Like, that's my...
Wonderful.
That's
my Thank you. I appreciate that.
My other theory ship is I want to give Sarah Ahmed's Complaint, which is a newer work of hers, where she is thinking about the sort of, like, what it means to complain and the institutional structures that both, like, open up but then foreclose the ability of one to complain. And I just sort of feel that Elizabeth and...
The Plato?
Both Plato.
Plagio, yeah.
Paige and Elizabeth, like, need to think about the role of complaint in their lives as, like, spy and becoming spy.
I think my theory ships, one is actually a little bit in conversation and maybe tension with that suggestion and that assignment, but I am going to theory ship Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morality to Paige and maybe also to Kimmy, I think.
Okay.
Just because, like, there's a certain, like, transvaluation of values that I think they're both, like, playing around with in their own lives, vis-a-vis, like, spying, vis-a-vis the truth. And so, like, there's questions about, like, are they going to respond with ressentiment? Are they going to respond with, like, some assertion of, like, life and energy? How do they come to know what it is they know about their parents? So we got some, like, knowledge questions, genealogy questions here, you know. And then we have, like, the doer and the deed is, I think, a classic spy question and is also, you know, one of the best parts of the genealogy. And then, in honor of Tatiana just reading America for Phil, we are going to give Tatiana, but also give fucking Ronald Reagan himself, Bonnie Honig's The Politics of Public Things, Neoliberalism, and the Routine of Privatization, right? So it's, like, very obvious. We could give them, you know, any sort of number of thinkers on neoliberalism. Like, we give them to David Harvey, we can give them Wendy Brown, we can give them Saskia Sassen, all of which, you know, are, I think, fitting with a joke about privatization, which I established in my own canon, at least, is one of the funniest jokes the Americans has ever made.
Love that you are the one to theory ship a little bit of Bonnie. And I also feel like it's appropriate in a, like, we do get Elizabeth in a phone booth in this episode. And so...
with some more bad green screen behind a phone booth.
Terrible green screen. Situations. It's like the biggest misstep the Americans make. But Bonnie, in the book that comes, that this essay becomes a part of...
Yes.
Loves a phone booth, loves a payphone. So it feels like there's a kind of continuity there. And that, like, I'm sure there's something about phone booths and privatization and neoliberalism that we could, like, get to.
There is. Also, in Public Things, we're going to theory ship some further. We're going to theory ship Danielle's favorite film, Melancholia, to Paige.
No, thank you.
And to Oleg.
Not interested.
And to Miss Ghost.
No.
Which is, I make that joke because Honig talks about Melancholia
in the Public Things book. So. Also, I'm sure, I definitely said this to John, but I don't know that I've said it on the podcast. In my brain, I confuse Melancholia with Elizabethtown, which is also in
Oh, you Kirsten definitely Dunst. Made that joke more than once previously on the
podcast. Have I? And I don't know. It. It's like so, it's such a real thing in my head.
Yeah.
Listen, I think with that, we have come to the end of our theory ships. We've come to the end of the cave, and we've come to the end of the episode.
We sure have.
Thanks, as always, to...
Danielle's dream of an hour and 30 remains deferred.
I was really trying this time, but alas, I had to postpone a sister debrief.
Uh-oh.
It's okay.
I feel genuinely bad.
Oh, no. Tori texted, like... right as we were starting to record and was like, oh, like, can everybody be ready for a debrief in a half an hour? And I was like, absolutely not. But at some point I was like, I'm still not ready. I'll join when I'm done. Thanks, as always, to producer Amy. Up next.
Shout out to producer Amy.
In 2 weeks, we have American Season 4, Episode 11, Dinner for Seven, with special guest Jordan Cass.
One of my like longest and dearest friends, loves the Americans, has been lots of smart thoughts about TV in general and the Americans in particular. And like, he watched it later than I did. And like, we have had several long email exchanges about the Americans, like in our distant past together. So I'm super excited. And also like, Jordan and I go way, way back, and he's a real one. So excited about that. Danielle, predictions for who the Dinner for Seven is?
I feel like it's
bonus dossier at the end.
Yeah, I feel like it is. Okay, it's the four Jennings. Henry, back.
Wonderful.
It's Pastor Tim and Alice. And
okay, that gets us to six.
And Stan.
Okay, we will see if Danielle's prediction
amazing
and bonus dossier comes true.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Not Quite Great Books,
a TV podcast. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Not Quite Great Books, a TV podcast. It's created by Daniel Hanley and John McMahon, and indirectly, producer Amy. You can find us on Twitter at NotGreatBooksTV. You can email us at NotGreatBooksTV@gmail.com. If you have comments or questions that we might potentially read and respond to on air, subscribe, download, rate, review us, tell your friends to find us at Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, and Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. We would like to thank Less FM for Electro Trend 60s, which is the music that you heard at the beginning and you are hearing right now. Until next time, go play some racquetball.